Hey, it's Garen here. Inflation keeps rising. There won't be a better time than right now to replace the roof following the storm damage. Let the Shamrock team treat you to a free inspection and we'll replace the damage with the best roof at the best price. One call does it all at shamrockroofer.com.
Move over, boys. It's time for She's on the Mic with Bethany Bowman on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
Welcome into She's on the Mic tonight. This evening, have a very special guest joining us. You know, the Chiefs lost this week, so not a lot to talk about there. But we have someone better. I've wanted to have this guy on my show for a while. I started at Sports Radio 810 in August, and one of the most welcoming people here in the office, and definitely one of the most interesting people, I think, too. Les Norman, you hear him on Sports Radio 810, Breaking the Norm host, has his own podcast and show, and it's great. So many real-life stories and just some great things you can find out on his show. But, Les, I'm excited to learn more about you and talk about your career. Former major leaguer, you're a keynote speaker, podcast, radio host, husband, father, so many different hats you wear. Yeah. Thank you for being here with us.
Absolutely. You know, I've known that you've been doing this, and this is a weird seat, Bethany. This is weird to be on this side of it. So, you know, you go do your thing, and I'll just sit over here and squirm when I'm not in the host seat.
Yeah, absolutely. You have no idea what questions are coming,
nope.
What we're going to talk about.
I like it that way, though. Okay. That's the organic Good. Side.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess we have to go back and kind of start at the beginning. You're from Michigan, right?
Well, yeah. Originally, I was born there, but I was so young that I don't remember anything. Just that, like, the road we lived on, the names of the people around me. But then we moved to Pennsylvania, and we were in Pittsburgh. I do remember some of that, like, at age 1 to 7. We were there, and just elementary school, not a lot going on, you know. And then it was when we moved to Illinois, where when I was about 7 and a half, where it kind of all started. So when people ask me, I say originally from Illinois area, like Joliet, south of Chicago area, and then those are just like Pennsylvania and Michigan are just born, and then a few years as a kid, but the majority of the memories are the Illinois part.
Okay, and you know, obviously, baseball becomes such a big part of your life later on. But, you know, when does that start? I always wonder, you know, for all these guys that are successful at something, is it, you know, from day one where you kind of hitting a ball, or how did that come to be?
You know, interestingly enough, I was not I was a baseball fan when I got to Illinois because you could pick up WGN. There wasn't really cable back then. And shortly after that, the Superstation TBS came on. So but WGN was on the verge of going national. It was still Chicago, and I love the Cubs and like the White Sox. Still don't like the White Sox. Was a Cub fan, so I'm a glutton for punishment, but at least back then. But I grew up with a really abusive dad, and he was a screamer and a yeller and an abuser and a hitter and an alcoholic, all those things. And so I remember the route I used to take from school to home went past the city park, the local baseball diamond. It's just little podunk park for the little kids and then one next to it for the bigger kids. And I was bullied a lot as a kid. I was kind of a loner. I'd stay in for recess because I liked to do math. And there was a father figure as our second grade teacher, Mr. Kekka, who I'd hang out with and learn some math and started tutoring fifth graders in math as a second grader. I just loved that. But I really was not athletic at all, and I wasn't interested in that. I was the kid that got pounded in dodgeball, just standing there like covering his face and just getting drilled. I mean, you can like see the old, you know, dodgeball movie and see those people. So I came home one day and mom and dad were yelling, screaming. He was doing his thing. And it was just one of those days. I had a bad day at school, couldn't take it anymore. And the first thing that popped into my head was those kids hanging out, playing slow pitch, home run derby, whatever they were playing at the local park. And all it was a path through some woods to get there. So it was only like a 2-minute bike ride. So I just put my books down on the patio, grabbed my bike, grabbed my glove, knowing they probably wouldn't let me play, but hightailed it over the park. And sure enough, they didn't let me play, but I watched, because I watched the way kids interacted. I didn't have a lot of friends. And eventually just watching and hanging out with them started to get me into the love of an organized sport. It just happened to be baseball.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's interesting because we always kind of, I guess for me especially, I'm probably a little guilty of it. I kind of think of, and especially here in Kansas City, because there's a lot of really great baseball talent. And I kind of think, you know, well, these kids have been playing in, you know, tournaments across the country forever. Right. They've kind of grown up with it.
Have instructors and private lessons.
Yeah, and we don't, obviously we don't know anybody's story, you know, truly, until we're in their shoes. But, you know, for you, it sounds like it wasn't an easy path.
Yeah, that's a good observation. It was not, but it, you know, being a man of faith, I didn't know it back then when I was a kid, and I wouldn't even grab a hold of my faith till my early 20s. But, you know, God was doing something in my life at that time. I didn't know it. It was a way of protection. It was a way of belonging. Again, at first, they didn't let me play, but one day they were a guy short, so they just stick me in right field. And I didn't even really realize that right field was an out, you know, because in home run derby, you're 3-on-3. So you have a pitcher, a shortstop, and an outfielder, 3-on-3. And so they had a pitcher, a deep shortstop, short right field or short left field, and then me out in right field. I didn't care. I was just glad to be a part of it. And so, yeah, we didn't have the money for that. My dad worked construction jobs, but he was didn't know this till later, but he was having an affair with my mom, and there's a whole other family in Michigan. He would travel. And so later on, we just found out that he kind of had like a whole nother family he was living with. And we thought it was just, well, some months he's gone, some months he's home. And I liked him being gone because there wasn't any stress. He wasn't hurting the family or anything. And so didn't have a lot of money, enough fees for me to join the Little League for about 10 to 12 games in a summer. But, oh, absolutely no travel ball, no instructors. But I really fell in love first with the belonging, with guys, with friends. And then started, I didn't really have a lot of talent. The only thing I could really do, I could run fast. I could throw the ball really far, but couldn't hit. Was afraid of the ball. Was not good. I tried out at second base in my first year. And there was one girl in town that was in baseball instead of softball. And there were only four baseball teams, small mm-hmm. town. And so they said, go to try out to the position you want. I go to second base and she goes to second base. I'm thinking, oh, well, this is going to be easy. And 5 minutes later, I was the starting right fielder on that team, and she was the all-star second baseman who went on to like play college in three different sports as an All-American. Wow. And two. Yeah, she's a stud. So Pat Folletti was her name. Anyway, so it was a tough road, especially being the smallest guy in school and not having the most talent. But when you grow up in a small town, there's no competition. They got to put you on a team. You're not getting kicked off. On my high school baseball team, the coach said, hey, what number do you want? Like, you haven't seen me play. Like, doesn't matter. We don't have enough guys. So just tell me what number you want to wear. So it wasn't traditional, but it was a little bit easier of a road being from a small town without the competition to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you went on and played college, obviously.
Yeah. Won a state championship in high school, too.
That is, you know, a world where you do have to be able to play to
right.
get to. So
yeah.
How did your game evolve? How did you and when did everything kind of start to look like maybe you do have some talent,
right.
you know?
As a freshman, I started to grow finally. You know, when I graduated eighth grade, I was about 4'10", 4'11". I was tiny. You know, you look in the pictures of the middle school and eighth grade, and like, why'd you put the sixth grader in the picture in the front row? That's me just sitting there, this tiny little kid. So I started to grow, and when you start to grow and the athletic talent comes along, you start to get attention. And then there was where the work ethic started. You know, I had the work ethic for school in middle school, elementary and middle school. But then once high school hit, I was just an average student, only because I wasn't as interested. Should have been, but wasn't. Dad had left by then, never saw him again after age 12. You know, I came home one day, mom said he was gone, never saw him again. But we had a great high school coach who really challenged me. It was the first father figure I had ever been around that challenged me to be a better player, what discipline really was. And we also had a great class that was 2 years older. So my freshman year, our junior class was the athletic class of that school, small school, but still they were the studs. And so by the time I was a sophomore, now I was a varsity starter instead of a freshman. You know, we had a freshman team I played then. Mm-hmm. But as a sophomore, I was a starting right fielder, except when our stud player named Brian Dubois pitched, and then he'd go into pitch, and then I'd slide over to center field. So I had all these guys to follow, and I had to work really hard just to keep up with those guys. But ended up doing pretty well as a sophomore. We won a state championship. That guy that was a center fielder ended up being the first pick in the fourth round his senior year at that high school.
Wow.
And you're talking a town of about 1,700 people, you know, it's a really small town, and a school of 300, and two guys off the same team end up playing in the major leagues, which is wild. That's the odds of that aren't
that's
great.
Crazy.
So, yeah, it was just that work ethic. We had won a state championship then, my sophomore year that year. He goes and gets drafted. We didn't get back to state my junior or senior year, but had a lot of winning seasons and just developed my talent there. And then only had one college come calling, the College of St. Francis in Joliet, Illinois, which is 20 miles to the north. And went there, played 1 year of football, 4 years of baseball, and still you think you're good in high school. And then you get to college and realize that just got you through high school. And so then we had one of the greatest high school coaches, Gordy Gillespie, in college history, winning record, been to multiple national championships. And so, yeah, got there. And it was another rude awakening of how good those guys were. But again, I figured, well, I've come this far. Let's push it. Let's see what can happen. And, you know, there you go.
Okay. Kind of talk about college and was it early on that you, I know you said the work ethic really got better and things started to elevate, but just when was it that maybe you kind of realized professional baseball was in your cards or in your future?
Well, so when, and I'm not trying to, I don't want to flip the script here, but I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
So when you
always do that.
Yeah. Well, it's just part of the nature. When you were a little girl, what did you want to be when you grew up? Do you remember?
Yeah. Doctor. But I'm not smart enough for that. So now I talk sports.
And I was going to be like a president, an astronaut, a cowboy, a doctor, all those things. And none of that came true either. So, you know, when we're little kids, you have this dream. And one of mine was I was going to be a big league player, but that's because I loved watching the Cubs play. That was how I filled it, you know. And I, again, not having a lot of friends when I was a little kid, I'd take a tennis racket and a wiffle ball on a windy day and hit it as high as I could in the air, drop the racket, and try to catch the wiffle ball blowing all over the place. And, you know, those one-sided wiffle balls with the holes in them move a lot more than the other ones do. And so when I got to college, it was really similar to the high school thing where the college had a freshman team and we had a pretty good collegiate team, a lot of seniors that were studs. One of them got drafted, but I don't think ever got out of A ball. But I would dress for a couple games and just kind of get like, wow, I'm in awe. This is crazy. This is. And so one morning as a freshman, we it was in February, January, there's a foot of snow outside in Illinois. And it's 5:30 in the morning. And we're in this old armory where in one side of the armory, there's tanks and Jeeps and, you know, these big long range guns. And I'm like, this is crazy. And we're a baseball team practicing on a hard tile floor, like this countertop, almost like granite. And he's having us dive on the floor for these balls. And there's 38 guys in this small gymnasium trying to practice and all that. And we took a bathroom break and I remember coming out and it was this fork in the road for me. And I had this conversation with myself, said, look, you said you wanted to be a major league player. Even if it was for the little boy reason, now either go and do everything it takes. Don't complain about the coaches. Don't complain about how difficult the road's going to be, how good these players are. You become the best you can be or do something else. And when I thought about that, I'm like, well, I really don't have anything else I want to do. So even if you don't like it, give everything you got and see what happens. And so the freshman year, I played on the freshman team, did really well. Sophomore year, ended up being a starter, was a starting center fielder my sophomore year. Lost in the national championship game in the NAI World Series after having a 5-run lead, by the way, in the last inning and lost 6-5. Yeah. But just got better and better, was an All-American, 2-time All-American that year, and just really had a good career, but I really worked hard. You know, there's so much specialization now in sports where people think that, well, if you want to be a major league player, you can only play baseball. If you want to be an NFL player, you can only play football. You know, we just came back from Royals Fantasy Camp the other day, and our guest was Eric Berry, who's a stud, obviously, at Tennessee and a stud for the Chiefs and battled cancer. And the guy's a hero, man. Guy loves baseball and played baseball and also ran track. And so I did all the sports because they made me better. You know, even in college that 1 year, I had to quit after my freshman year of college in football because I was getting crushed. When you're 160 returning kicks and punts, you're getting destroyed by college football players. But I just kept that work ethic and had that dream of trying to become a Major League Baseball player. And whether it was real or not, I didn't care. I didn't care what people thought. Didn't care about my size. I just worked really, really hard. And like I said, became a 2-time All-American and almost won a national championship, but just had a lot of fun doing it.
So 25th round you're drafted by?
The second time, yeah.
Okay. What was the first time?
First time after my junior year was a 23rd round by Boston, but turned it down to finish my senior year.
Okay. Why was that? Hard decision?
No, it was, I had this idea that for the car and the rest of my education, because I didn't have a vehicle, and I wanted to pay for the rest of my college. And so that, to me, came out to be about $50,000. I'd mapped it out. And their initial offer was $2,000. I said, no thanks, no way. I gotta make sure that I get that paid for, because my family had, we had no money. And so I went to play summer ball in college and like was close to winning the Triple Crown, was continuing. I had my best year of college was my junior year. Shattered a bunch of school records, and again, led the team in a lot of different categories. Was voted one of the top 10 players in the country, all divisions. Ooh. And so, yeah, so I'm thinking 23rd round, I was kind of hoping top 10 round, but again, at the time, 5'11", 175. It's not from Texas, 6'3", you know, mm-hmm. 220. So the money didn't come up. And I probably didn't have the best advice in my ear either. It was someone that was knowledgeable whether I should sign or not. So I just turned it down, fully expecting that I have a great senior year, and didn't. So then I think the Royals drafted me after my senior year in the 25th round based on what I did my junior year, because I did mm-hmm. not have a great senior year. I was starting to battle some mental stuff, some depression issues in college. And so still got drafted, though, and ended up signing with the Royals after my senior year, 25th round.
Well, after all of this, seems like a long road already.
Yeah.
You found out the work was just beginning.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about that here in just a second. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Les Norman here on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
You're tuned in to She's on the Mic with Bethany Bowman on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
We're back here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. You're listening to She's on the Mic with your host, Bethany Bowman. That's me, but sitting across from me, Les Norman here of Sports Radio 810 WHB, host of Breaking the Norm, former major leaguer. We're talking about his journey to the show. And Les, we just finished up kind of the college journey for you. We're now to getting drafted in the 25th round after your senior year. And like we mentioned, kind of the work just beginning. Take us through the initial, you know, you get drafted, everybody's probably excited for you, they're telling you congratulations. Not a lot of people realize kind of just the beginning that this is.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I have what I'm getting ready to tell you, I've never told anybody before.
Oh, wow.
Because it never hit me until right now.
Okay.
So you can see as we tell the story, there's a pattern developing. You know, I didn't go to the baseball field when I was a kid for baseball. I just wanted to belong. You know, I wanted to have that community, right? And so then you get to high school and you realize, okay, now the real work starts. And you get to college, okay, now the real work starts. Well, after I had signed, when I got on the plane, and this is the thing that I'd never told anybody, I had never felt more lonely in my life than when I got on that airplane. Because then I realized I have no tether tied to me back home. I've got my high school coach who was supportive, all my teachers, whatever, you know, my mom and sister, friends, but anybody that could be there to support me, that I could go hang out with, that I could go sit with and, you know, go have a cup of coffee with or whatever it may be, that was all gone. As a pro now, you're on a plane, you don't have your hitting coach, you don't have your outfield coach, you don't have anything. And all your stuff got you to sign that piece of paper, but it can't hit for you with a wood bat that I'd never done before. It can't go against the first rounder from Texas that you're going to be facing, or Florida or Miami, or, you know, all these big universities. And so when I got on that plane, there was the realization that you're alone, and whatever you think you had to do to get here, push it all aside, because like you just said, now the real work begins. And even though I said that 2, 3, 4 times in my life, I meant it every time, but each time it carried more weight. And so, yeah, I was lonely. And when I got there, the first thing I noticed was, because I'd never hit with a wood bat before, we're taking batting practice the first day. And there's guys from California, Arizona, Texas, Florida. They're playing baseball year-round. I'm from Chicago. I've played games in a snowstorm before where you can't pick the ball up from all the flakes, you know, coming into your face. And so these guys were launching bombs in batting practice, and the sound off their bat was incredible. And here I've never hit with a wood bat, so I'm trying to muscle up. I can barely get the ball to the infield. And I started to notice, like, I was back in Braidwood, Illinois, as that little kid again, like, you're not enough. You can't do what these kids can do. And it was scary. And that drove me to two things. One, a big place of humility. Like, if you don't put this big braggy thing on, because the truth is in what they see every day, and you can't hit like these guys, you can't play like, I could run like them or better. I definitely had the arm. I could outthrow anybody. I mean, back even in the big leagues, there might have been two guys that had a better arm than me, Ken Griffey Jr. and Jay Buhner, both on the Seattle Mariners. But nobody else could compare, because I just always had the gift of that and I took care of it. But that was a real big eye-opener for me. And so I was hitting, playing a little bit, not starting every day. I was hitting 169. And when you're a 25th round pick and you're hitting 169...
That ain't
going to
cut it.
Not going to cut it at all. I mean, 269 might cut, but it's 100 points lower. And so our manager was a guy named Tom Poquette. I said, Pokey, listen, I love this game. I know I'm not playing well. I know I could be one of the first guys out the door and get released. But until that day comes, I'll give you everything I have. So I want to come early. I want to stay late. Teach me how to hit with a wood bat. Soft toss with me. I'll do the tee work. I'll do all the work. Just show me. I'll buy your lunch if I have to. Even though I'm only making $100 a month before taxes playing baseball, I'll do whatever I can. And he agreed. He said, you know, you've got heart. I watch you play outfield. You run into walls like I do. You play outfield like I do. You're a gritty guy. And obviously you want to work, and that's what I want to see. I don't want the prima donna stuff. So you be here tomorrow, and I'll be here ready to go. And so every day, every morning, every night, I worked on my hitting and got after it. So it was another realization of, okay, the real work starts now.
Yeah, I have a few follow-up things just on that short answer you had there. You know, you talked about kind of the intrusive thoughts, and I think there's a fine line. You talked about humility, which we usually kind of perceive as a good thing. That's if you have humility, that's a compliment.
Sure.
But especially in the sports world, you also need confidence. There's like a fine line between, you know, knowing that you need to, you know, maybe step it up to be with some of these guys that you're facing, but also, you know, you don't want to be insecure when you're out there, you know, fighting for your job, fighting for your life.
It's a great point.
How do you kind of manage that?
It's a great point, Bethany. Gosh, I need you to co-host my show sometimes. That's really good. So I think part of it, there's two parts to that. The first part was in the outfield. It was confidence. That was the confidence of nobody's going to be better than me. Now, nobody's going to be worse than me. I wasn't thinking I'm better than everybody in the world, but I was confident in who I was. I could run anything down. I remember back in the first segment, I talked about hitting the ball up in the air, the wiffle ball and all that. I think I got a lot of my skill from all those backyard games of playing in the neighborhood or just hitting the ball, throwing a ball against the wall by myself, whatever it may be. And so I was confident there. And then when I hit, I loved the feel of a bat in my hand since I was 8 years old. Just holding it, I didn't have any issues of like ADD or anything like that, or I just had to have this certain feel or anything, but I love the feel of it. I used to like literally put the bat in bed with me and just hold it and just dream about myself hitting, even as a 20-something, because I just loved to hit. The problem was I just wasn't good at it. So I was confident in the outfield, and where I lacked confidence in hitting, there was still enough humility to understand. Here's the funny thing. I'll put it this way. The next season in full season A ball, I shouldn't even have been there. I should have gotten released. I mean, from 169, I got my average up to 245. So there was enough of an improvement there that they said, okay, he's getting it. You know, I'd gotten injured the first time, and my first two at-bats coming back, I hit two opposite field home runs. Bethany, I never hit an opposite field home run in my life. I don't even know how it happened at the time, but later on I realized, you know, you're staying back, you're trying to hit the ball where it's pitched versus trying to just launch and do all these things. The humility part came to me was, look, everything you're trying to do is not working. Pokey took the time to teach you. Tom Poquette took the time to teach you. So the humility lies in, take what you've learned, and if it works, great. If it doesn't, at least you gave everything you got. But there are people in this game that know more than you do. And so I put every single thing he taught me into play. And I celebrated small victories where I might not have got a hit that day, but I might have hit the ball hard. Or I didn't get a hit, but I didn't strike out. I didn't ground out three times to the shortstop because I'm trying to muscle up. And so the game in my head changed. It helped me mature a lot more by having the humility to follow someone who believed in me. Mm-hmm. And one of the first men in my life that ever did believe in me and stuck his neck out for me. And so I followed him and gained confidence in the batter's box, and that's where it all kind of came together.
And the other thing was $100 a month before taxes.
$800.
800. Oh, okay. Yeah, 800. Okay. I was like, oh my God.
Not 100. No, it was 800, but it 800. Felt like 100.
I bet. Yeah. I was going to say, and I don't know what the comparison was like as far as, you know, obviously kind of different time and things like that, but that's still a very low amount of money. And I know that we talk about even today minor leaguers' pay and, all, you know, benefits and things like that, but it has gotten a lot better.
Oh, yeah. This past couple of years it has.
How did you make it work?
Well, we lived in a place in Eugene, Oregon. First of all, in Eugene, Oregon, it wasn't real expensive to live.
That's
we lived like a mile or two from the park, and we had this quad where think of the number five on a set of dice, right, on a die, and the number five. So the outer corners were the bedrooms, the tiny little bedrooms, which had their own little bathroom in there.
Yeah.
And then right in the middle was this common area
living
that
space,
was the kitchen, the living space, whatever you want to call it. And basically it was four lawn chairs and this really bad plastic rickety table. That's how we lived in that first year.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then, of course, long bus rides. No flights.
Oh, yeah.
No plane rides.
Nope. Not one. Not even if you were in the playoffs. No, those were long bus rides. But again, to me, I'm getting paid to play. I mean, my signing bonus was $2,000.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is that when I got drafted by Boston, their first offer was $2,000. They eventually upped it to $30,000, and I still turned it down because I just still couldn't make it work. Again, not getting the best advice, probably wasn't as maybe humble as I should have been. Still glad I did it, because if I wouldn't have come to Kansas City, I don't have my family. It's a whole different story. But that signing bonus of $2,000 was more than my first 2.5 months of regular pay. Playing for the Royals in the minor leagues. And so, again, you're talking 1991. It's a long time ago. It's 32 years ago. So, yeah, but you make it work because you're getting paid to play what you love to do.
Yeah, I can't get over how many people don't realize, I guess, that it's not luxurious. I remember it was somebody, I don't remember his name, he signed with the Cardinals. He was, I think it was an outfielder for LSU a few years ago when they were in the World Series. So, I mean, he was a high prospect, but he had the funniest tweet. It was a screenshot. Some girl had sent him and said, "Hey, I'm gonna be." He got drafted by the Cardinals. She's like, "I'm gonna be in St. Louis this weekend. You think I could get some tickets to the Cardinals game?" And he's in like high A.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, "The front office doesn't even know me. Like, you know, they don't even sometimes know the guys that are in their farm system.
Right.
If they saw him on the street, so he's like, "No, you will not be getting any tickets here to the big league game in St. Louis." So it's just kind of cool to hear that your perspective on this stuff. Big league debut. Can you just describe, I guess, how that went about? Did you get a phone call? The emotions you felt? Just kind of take us through that moment.
So we're in AAA and we're playing a game. We're beating somebody like 17-5 or something like that. We're hammering this team in AAA in Omaha. And so when you're up by 10 runs, you're not stealing. And so there's two outs. I'm on first base and get my secondary lead. I'm not stealing. And the guy that's at the bat, Keith Hughes, flies out deep. And so I go first to third. He catches it. Innings over. Take my helmet off. Give it. And it's Mike Gerschle was my manager, who was the Royals third base coach for quite a long time. And loved Gersh. And so Gersh said, "Hey, did you miss the sign?" And I said, "I didn't miss the sign. You didn't give any signs." And he's like, "Don't you blankety blank tell me what I did and didn't do." And he was really mad. I'm like, "Oh my gosh, we're winning like by 15 runs." And he's mad at me because he thinks he didn't even give a sign. So I walked out to Keith Hughes between innings. He was an outfielder as well. We're playing catch. I said, "Hughesy, did you see Gersh give a sign?" He's like, "He didn't give a sign. We're up 15 runs." I said, "That's what I told him. And he just aired me out." So I go back in after the inning's over. I said, "Gersh, ask Hughes. He didn't see a sign either." He's like, "Hughesy couldn't find his you-know-what in a paper bag. I mean, you got to be kidding me." And so I was like, "Okay, fine." So after the game was over, he comes out, and we're all celebrating. You know, I think I had like four hits that game. Everybody had a lot of hits that game. It was a great day. And again, you're a AAA. I mean, I haven't been to the big leagues yet, but who knows? And I'm hitting like 368. So I'm wondering, but, you know, just stay with the program. So Gersh comes out, and he's like, "Hey, Les, get the blankety blank." He starts like yelling at me and completely kills the vibe in the clubhouse.
Oh,
yeah. He's like, "Get in the locker room." And my pants were around my ankles. I was literally pushing down my pants, getting ready to get in the shower, taking my uniform off. And I'm like, "Can I get dressed first?" He's like, "See, it's that attitude that's going to get you." I'm like, "Okay, dude, I'll be right there." So I still have my sliding shorts on. I go into the clubhouse. I go into his office. And as I go into his office, there's the minor league roving hitting instructor. the minor league catching instructor, the minor league director of operations, and the pitching coach in a semicircle with a chair in the middle.
Do you think you're getting cut?
I thought I was like, I'm done. I'm like, I didn't think I had that bad of an attitude, but holy cow. And I'm hitting 368. I'm going to get released or maybe get traded.
Yeah.
And for me at the time, I didn't want to get traded because all my friends were here. The Royals organization is all I knew. So he sits down and he starts yelling at me and I don't say a word. And he says, and besides, tomorrow when you're in Kansas City, if you do that, they'll send you right back here. I'm like, you know what? Wait, what? What'd you say?
That's cool.
They all busted up laughing. The whole thing was a setup from the beginning of the day. The sign to make me think I was in trouble during the game, all that stuff.
That's me.
Yeah, it was. But when you get called up to the big leagues and you're realizing a dream, he's like, here's my phone. Call whoever you need to call. And they hugged me and I was crying and it was an amazing day. And so, yeah, I called my parents. And the second person I called was my college coach my high school coach and then my college coach. And then just got dressed, went home, got up the next morning, got on a plane, quick flight from Omaha in. I didn't drive and walked into the clubhouse that looked like it was the biggest room I'd ever been in my life. And remember what we keep talking about. Now the real work starts.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my first thought.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who was maybe this chance to, I guess, shed some glory to someone else? Who was the most welcoming player to you once you got to the bigs?
There were two guys. Jeff Montgomery, obviously, one of our friends here at Union Broadcasting, and Mark Gubza, who was he's a Royals Hall of Famer. He actually was on my show last week, and I got to see him at Fantasy Camp. And they weren't like buddy-buddy, but they understood being a rookie. They weren't. I mean, I got hazed by some guys. I got put down by some guys. My manager was Bob Boone, who was a manager. Like, if you're a rookie, you shut your mouth and you take it. And he was not my favorite manager. I mean, of all the managers I ever had, you're not going to like everybody.
Yeah.
I had a lot that I liked, a couple that I loved, and only one that I couldn't stand. And it was Bob Boone. I mean, really, I couldn't. But I was still in the big leagues. He was still the manager. And you got to learn how to get along with people. And Mark Gubza and Jeff Montgomery were the guys that this is how you need to act. This is what you need to do. This is when you talk. This is when you don't. This is when you always need to stay ready. This is how you need to respect your players. Don't ever be about yourself. Your stats will take care of themselves if you're a team player. You know, back in A-ball, when I was going to get released and was going to be the fifth outfielder on my first full season in low A-ball, I remember thinking that, look, you're lucky to even be here. Just be the best teammate. If you have to chase foul balls, keep the scorebook, sell hot dogs in the concession stand, I don't care. You serve everybody around you. And by All-Star break, I was hitting over 400 and got promoted to Double-A. So it's awesome. Interesting that when you serve other people and you take the focus off of yourself, the real athlete in you starts to come out. And you become a better teammate and you become a better leader to those around mm-hmm. you. And so that's what Gooby and Monty taught me. And even though I only played two seasons with the Royals, two seasons in the big leagues, or season and a half, whatever you want to call it, I wouldn't have made it that long without those two guys.
Any favorite memories in your entire time in the majors?
Yeah, you get to witness a lot of things. You know, being a big leaguer when Cal Ripken broke that all-time Ironman record was really cool. The Brewers were in town when Paul Molitor got his 3,000th hit. That was pretty cool. Playing right field and Ken Griffey Jr. hitting a line drive base hit to right and Luis Soho trying to score from second and me throwing him out. Mm-hmm. I threw him out. It was a perfect throw to home. And he was out by so far that he stopped halfway and just let the catcher go tag him. He knew he was out. He didn't even get in a rundown. And then Ken Griffey Jr. kind of giving you the look and tipping his cap like, hey, kid, you know, that was really cool.
That's cool.
Stuff like that. I mean, you know, coming up and I think the other one, was coming up in September of 95, and the Royals are half game down in the wild card. It was like the only close time in my time that they were even close to being in the playoffs. Guys on first and second, he calls me up to pinch hit. I'm exhausted. You know, I've just got called up. I'm tired. I didn't sleep. And the guy's going to throw an inside pitch, and I'm going to try to turn on it and pull it, right? Well, my bat's so slow, I can't. So I take the first pitch inside. It's close, and he calls the ball. And I knew the catcher from AAA, Randy Knorr, and we were buddies. And I knew what he was doing, but I didn't say anything. So the next pitch, I saw it out of my hand. or out of the pitcher's hand, but I couldn't get out there, so I just had to stay inside. And somehow I snuck a triple down the first baseline, 2-run score, and we end up winning that game, going a half a game up in the wild card. That was pretty memorable. And the other thing is just getting a hit off Randy Johnson, you know, the Hall of Famer, one of my idols in baseball. Those 100 miles an hour, he's the first 100-mile-an-hour pitcher I ever saw. Well, I heard the ball come in. I don't know if I saw it, but that was pretty neat too. And then just, you know, winning a gold medal in the Junior Olympics was really cool. Yeah. Playing on the U.S. Olympic team, White Sox manager Pedro Grifol, who was the Royals bench coach, got to play on the U.S. Olympic team. I got hurt and had to leave the team. I didn't get to finish with them, but playing and with some of those guys. When you get to represent your country and win a gold medal, you're talking a 5'11", 160-pounder, you know, a kid that got picked on and bullied, mm-hmm. winning a gold medal, playing in the major leagues. I mean, you know, getting to work with great people like you and being on TV, being on radio, being a speaker, all those things came from just spending that one day in the big leagues. And so I attribute all that to the Lord, because, you know, I'm a man of faith, and he had my path directed. It wasn't always easy. I wasn't always obedient. But the bottom line is, this has afforded me an incredible life. So yeah, here we are.
Absolutely. Well, one thing about you that I'll tell you is, obviously, you've got crazy history. You know, not everybody's in the major leagues.
Right.
Not everybody did and went through a lot of the things that you went through, too. You know, when you talk about kind of your upbringing and facing adversity, things like that. A lot of people, though, I think, have kind of the story to tell, whether it's in the major leagues or not. But mm-hmm. it's also about how you deliver it and how you relate to people and how you can kind of intertwine it all. And you've obviously found the way to do that mm-hmm. With your keynote speaking, on your podcast, like all the stuff that you just mentioned. So kind of just, what is your main focus when you do that kind of stuff? Tell us, when you go out in a keynote, what are you sharing? What's your main mission?
Yeah, that's great. I've been asked that question before. And I think people expect the answer of, well, you got to do your research. You know this. I mean, you're a reporter, and you have to watch the game, and you have to study intently. You understand this. And people that do what we do understand that. And even as a speaker, it's kind of the same thing. You have to research. You have to know your subject. You have to be passionate about that. And I did have to learn all those things. But the main thing for me that has made it easy, and I'm not saying I haven't gotten nervous over the 20-some years I've been doing it. I mean, I've spoken in front of 10 people, and I've keynoted in front of 10,000 people, and everywhere in between. And you're nervous no matter what the audience is. But the big thing for me is loving people, just loving people, understanding that, you know, my former chaplain with the Royals, Mike Lusardi, who's since passed away, used to always say, behind every face, there's a drama unfolding. And what he's trying to say is that everyone has a story, like you just mm-hmm. said. We all have a story. And most people either think they know or don't take the time to get to know people. And so I want to know about people. I want to know what makes them tick. And then the one thing, speaking wise, I think I learned before all the other stuff is, when I talk in front of a lot of people, I look for active listeners. If someone's really looking at me, like right now, people can't see this, but I'm looking at you intently. I'm looking at you in the eyes, like I'm interested in what you're saying. And so when you find people like that in the audience, you stay on them mm-hmm. because it gives you comfort. It gives you yeah. peace in what you're doing, and you're comfortable giving it. So when you're passionate about what you're saying, when you love people and know you have something to give them, have the confidence to know you have something to give them, then it becomes easier and easier the more you do it. So I can't believe that I get to be on the radio, be on TV, do podcasting, speak for a living, coach people in business and executives and prospects coming up in organizations. I get to do that. I don't have a career. I just play around and people pay me for it.
It's awesome. Well, a few more things I have up my sleeve for you, Les. But quick break here today on Sports Radio 810 WHB. She's on the mic. I'm Bethany Bowman. We'll be right back with Les Norman.
You're tuned in to She's on the Mic with Bethany Bowman on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
We're back here again on She's on the Mic on Sports Radio 810 WHB. I'm Bethany Bowman. So excited to be joined here by Les Norman. We've been talking to all evening. Again, Les is someone that I've been really excited to have on my show. An interesting human being, obviously a former major leaguer, but doing so much now with the gifts, the tools, and all the resources that you've learned and acquired through your major league career, and doing great things. So back on the, you know, the keynote speaking, the podcast, just talked about loving people on our last segment.
Yeah.
I guess, what's your advice for, you know, anybody kind of looking just for, looking for joy? I read something on your website, and it said you found true joy through your faith and family.
Yeah.
I don't know how I want to word this. I guess joy, being happy, something I think everybody wants, right?
Yeah.
But obviously life happens, you know, mm-hmm. things happen. There's a lot of grief in life, I guess, is the best way to put it. We're disappointed a lot. Things happen we're not ready for, we don't expect. Nobody's happy every single day of their life.
Right.
But how do you, I guess, embody happiness majority of the time or learn to find the happiness kind of through the mess?
Yeah, Bethany, you're good at this. That's a great question. I think that one of the secrets I've learned in life is that happiness and sadness are outside influences, or they're emotions that we have based on outside influences.
Yeah.
So if you or I get a phone call that's not good news, we're going to be sad.
Mm-hmm.
If all of a sudden, you know, we have a big grocery bill and the person in front of us just spent $300 anonymously and paid for our groceries, you know, just stuff like that.
Yes.
There are things that make us happy, things that make us sad. It's relationships, it's health, it's career, it's life, it's all those things. But oftentimes, joy is associated with happiness. And although it makes sense, and it kind of is, it's also the difference. There's a difference between happy and joy. Joy is a decision that we make every day based on knowing who we are and understanding that things are going to make us happy, things are going to make us sad. I can be sad and joyful at the same time. And I learned that again through my faith. My first year of pro ball, I'd mentioned this just a little bit, but I was really battling depression and didn't know it. My first year pro ball, I was also in a position where when I got hurt the second time and my season was over, I had contemplated suicide, and I was really in a dark place. And I had a guy named Bobby Meacham who I would go to chapel every Sunday just because I needed something good in my life. I raised enough hell for 6 days. I wanted to get a clean up on the seventh day and then probably go right back to it. But, you know, coming to a faith in the Lord, becoming a Christian, giving my life to the Lord and living for Him has helped me realize that there's always so much to live for. I know that, you know, the Bible is the most important book, the most important life story, lesson that it will ever be in my life. And so I can't be the husband and father I am without my faith in the Lord. I cannot be a joyful person. So I think it's all about perspective. Even on my worst day, I'm still here. God loves me because He sent His Son to die for me. I have an amazing wife of 27 years who is the most loyal, joyful, amazing human being on the planet. I have two healthy, smart, funny, goofy sons that just also love life and are joyful. And so we all want to have 100 things to complain about. But when you realize who you are, if you're a child of God and know that He saved you, He died for you, He loves you, and you every morning I want to wake up thankful, like, okay, Lord, You've given me life, You've given me my wife, You've given me my sons, You've given me a career, You've given me people that I can spend time with and love, and it doesn't get any better than that. And so I'll be happy and sad, but I will always be joyful.
That's good. That's awesome. Husband, father, keynote speaker, former major leaguer, podcast, radio host, also Wheel of Fortune contestant.
there it is.
I don't know how I found that.
It's on my bio, too.
I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
We don't have a lot of time, so I'll condense it.
Okay.
So when my youngest son was 11, we were sitting on the couch, and I was rattling off. I love the show. I've loved it since I was a kid. I was rattling him off. He wanted the last puzzle. I couldn't wait, and I said the puzzle. And he's like, all right, you're trying out. He had me do a video, but I forgot to do the video. He came in one day, and he said, did you make the video for Wheel of Fortune? I'm like, oh, buddy, I'm sorry. And he said, well, then I guess you're a promise breaker, Daddy. I'm like, wow. So we ran upstairs, did the video. They called.
Oh, wow.
A couple months later, first they had like a tryout in Kansas City Crown Center. Went down there, didn't think I was going to get picked, didn't get a call back. A couple months later, like 2 days before the deadline that you had to wait, they called and said, hey, you made the show. So I ran to school or drove to school. My son was getting ready to go in a cross-country meet. because he had told me, if you make, you're going to make the show if you send this video in. I just want you to know. And he said, and when you do, not if you do, but when you do, you're taking me out of school because I want to go to Hollywood. And he said, I want, there's four of us in the family. I want 25% of your winnings. I'm like, are you serious? He's like, yeah, whatever you win, because I'm the one that got you on here. I said, okay, no problem. Yeah. And so I ran there and told him, and I said, we're going. It's unbelievable. I just got the call. And he was getting ready to run his cross-country meet. I said, are you not excited? And he said, look, I told you. You're going to be on the show. And besides, Daddy, I believe in you.
Aww.
Oh. Sorry, that's – I almost made a whole show without getting emotional. So, yeah, I was emotional at the time, and I ran to the finish line. Oh, see you later.
How old was he?
He was 11.
Oh, wow.
He was 11, turning 12. So I went, and they do six shows in a day, and I was the sixth show. Didn't have a great start, but ended up running the table in the last four puzzles and ended up winning. Got to the bonus round. I thought it was going to be geography. I picked place. I thought it was going to be geography, but the puzzle was the usual hangout, which is a bunch of U's.
Ah,
so I didn't get it.
That's impossible.
And you know what envelope I picked? 100 grand.
Oh, man.
So I didn't get that, but I won an eight-day trip to Costa Rica for two. So I got a second honeymoon with my wife. It was amazing. And I won 12 grand in cash, so I got to give my son $3,000 to put in his account.
Jeez. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was fun.
Okay. Any final thoughts? Like you said, you're normally asking the questions. Yeah. It's been so good to actually kind of give you the freedom to talk, because this is awesome. But if you want to sign off on the show, it's all yours. The floor is yours.
Well, no, I'll just say this. One of the things I love about you, Bethany, is that you're also a people person. And you're really good at what you do. You're a professional. But every day I come into this place, when I see you, you smile. You greet people well. You're very friendly. You're a welcoming person to be around.
Thank you.
And you say that about me, but that's why I was drawn to you. Because you also are a lover of people.
Oh, yeah.
You care about people. You're interested. And when you work hard, you're good at what you do. I get to watch you, you know, do the interviews and the sideline reporting and hear you do your show and all that. And so you are somebody that has a really bright future, and just keep doing what you're doing, because a lot of people can learn from you, and you also carry a joy and humility about you, and that's going to get you really far in life. So I'll sign off by giving you a greatest compliment that I can give you, is that you're a really cool person to be around, and you're gonna do very well.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You got it.
Yeah, normally talk sports here on She's on the Mic, college football, Chiefs, whatever it may be, but this was a great dose of, you know, sports and life talk. I loved it. Thank you so much, Les, and hope to talk to you soon.
You got it. Thank you so much. Anytime.